Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of You Make Me Sick. Today we are joined by April Ramsey. April is the COO of Boston's Healthcare for the Homeless program. April has been with Boston's Healthcare for the Homeless program for 14 years, starting in 2011 as a clinic staff nurse and at the shelter partner, Pine Street Inn. In 2013, she transitioned to a respite staff nurse at the Barbara McGinnis House Respite Program. And in that same year, April began coverage as the respite nursing supervisor and later as the interim respite director of case management. During this time, April also helped develop the care management program with the Commonwealth Care Alliance One Care Program here in Boston. She served as one of the first nurse care managers on that team. In 2016, April was named site director of the Pine Street Inn Clinics, and after 2 years became the associate director of clinical operations for the program. In August 2024, April was appointed the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless Program's chief operating officer. April started her career at the CAB Health and Recovery Services in Danvers, Massachusetts, and in Boston. And from 2014 to 2022, she also held the role of public health clinical instructor for Northeastern University School of Nursing. April holds a BS in nursing from Northeastern University and has completed clinical roles at children's hospitals in Boston and Philadelphia. We are grateful to have April here with us today just to share information about an under-recognized program in Boston, and I'm sure in other cities here in the United States, as Boston's Healthcare for the Homeless program. April, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm very happy to have you.
Thank you, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I guess we'll kind of start at the beginning anyway. So the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless program, it began 40 years ago, and I was wondering if you could share just a little bit about the history of the Healthcare for the Homeless program, maybe about how it started.
Sure, I'd be happy to. And our program, like you mentioned, is turning 40 this year. And we've had quite a journey in our 40 years. We started in the 80s as a pilot program from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation grant. And through that grant, we were funded to start trying to care for folks experiencing homelessness. And we started actually at the Pine Street Inn Nurses Clinic, where our president and founder, Dr. Jim O'Connell, had been charged with this grant and took the opportunity in what he thought was going to be a year off between his residency and other ambitions, and he's still here with us 40 years later. And so Jim was connected with a nurse that's very well known throughout the city of Boston named Barbara McGinnis. And Barbara McGinnis at the time was working alongside the Boston Public Health Commission to help fight TB in the shelters. So she was working at the Pine Street Inn shelter, which at the time was experiencing quite a bit of tuberculosis in their population. And so Barbara and some of the other nurses that had formed the Pine Street Nurses Clinic actually had recognized that the Pine Street shelter needed a nurses clinic because they were nurses that were working out of Boston City Hospital emergency department, which is now Boston Medical Center. And so the nurses actually started volunteering at Pine Street because they appreciated that they were seeing folks in the emergency department, but they weren't meeting their needs. And so Jim was introduced to Barbara, and Barbara kindly told him to take his stethoscope off, put it in the drawer, and to just sit and soak feet and listen to patients before he would be allowed to tell them that he was a doctor and to offer any type of doctor or medical care. And so the story is much more impactful hearing it from Jim. But essentially, Barbara told him to go sit, be quiet, and listen. And I think that that is the foundation that Jim has laid for the rest of us in what makes the care we provide quite so profound, because we truly start with the patient. And so Jim listened to Barbara and was patient. And after several weeks or months, she gave him the green light to let folks know that he was a doctor and that he, you know, could meet any care needs that they were interested in discussing. And I think that that initial foundation of not just listening to patients, but being in a service mentality of soaking feet as an initiation is really helpful in understanding why we're successful in the care that we provide to some of the most vulnerable folks.
It's pretty impressive that he did that. So it's something that, you know, anybody who's worked around healthcare and healthcare physicians aren't always the most tactful or the most involved with the patients. Some are just socially awkward. Some don't think it's part of what they have to do. They're there to assess and prescribe and treat, and they don't really get involved with the kind of personal aspect of care. So I think that's it actually speaks to, probably why the program became successful, I think, was his involvement and just actually, you know, listening to the patients to provide that care, which, you know, like you said, it's a vulnerable population, but it's also one that it's often dismissed, I think. So pretty cool.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think the other important piece is that, you know, coming from Mass General, Jim also appreciated what our folks experience on the inpatient side of care. And that often is very challenging for folks experiencing homelessness because they're giving up a lot of control when they're in an inpatient unit. And I think that Jim has aligned our relationships both with Mass General, and now we have a very strong relationship with Boston Medical Center, such that we as a program have relationships with these inpatient hospitals and can really help navigate both care transitions, but also supporting our folks when they are inpatient, such that they can stay as long as they need to get their inpatient needs met, but also that we can help to navigate what health outcomes can be successful once they come back to the community.
And that's a big problem that people might not realize in hospitals is often, you know, most of recovery doesn't happen in the hospital for people, especially nowadays, because hospitals, there's higher risk of infection, just all kinds of other issues you can run into. So a lot of times people will stay in the hospital for, you know, the least amount of time they need to, and then go home and get care at home, or they'll go to a rehab facility. But for this population, if you're homeless, don't have a home. So the ability to actually stay in the hospital is probably so beneficial, especially for those who need long-term antibiotics, or if they need wound care, or just things they can't get, you know, if you're homeless. So pretty cool.
Yes. And I think that's a great segue into talking about our medical respite care at Boston Healthcare for the Homeless program. So we have the Barbara McGinnis House, which is a 103-bed medical respite unit here at our 780 Albany Street location. And we also have the Stacy Kirkpatrick House, which is a 20-bed step-down unit of medical respite out in Jamaica Plain. And so right now we have 120 plus beds of medical respite, but medical respite really started at the beginnings of our programming within some of our shelter partners, where we recognized that folks coming out of an inpatient unit weren't able to go back to the street or the shelter in a traditional way. And as you mentioned, most folks may go home with a visiting nurse or a physical therapist. And so when our patients are in a situation where they're not able to stay on the street or the shelter because of an acute medical need, medical respite fills that gap. And so within the Barbara McGinnis House and Stacy Kirkpatrick House, patients can come from an inpatient unit where they may need continued wound care or antibiotics or supports in recovery and mental health. And we're able to provide that in a short-term way where folks may come, you know, for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks so that we can support them in what return to the community might look like and ensure that, you know, that that wound is healed or that that medication regimen has been completed. And then fortunately, we also after respite are hoping to connect our patients or make follow-up appointments with existing connections that we already have in our outpatient clinics. So we have a robust array of outpatient clinics that are outside of our 780 Albany Street location, really places in which we're guests with our partners. And so, like you mentioned, I started out as a nurse at the Pine Street Inn clinic, and our clinics at Pine Street, we are guests in the shelter, just like the patients that we serve. And so we're able to really be where folks are already having needs met. So whether that's in a shelter or in a space where they might be having a meal, and that allows for patients to take care of their healthcare needs while they're also addressing other needs that they have on the daily.
So you mentioned there's 120 beds, which sounds like a lot, but are there often times where you guys are at capacity or you have to shuffle around? Because I know that we'll often refer patients who borrow McGinnis from my unit when they're ready to leave the hospital, but you can't go back on the street. And there's a multitude of reasons for that, medically necessary, that they have to have some kind of ongoing care. How do you guys, when you assess patients, how do you, you know when it's time for somebody to leave? How do you do your admitting process? Is that something that becomes a little bit tricky if you don't have a lot of space?
Yes, I would say our respite leadership team and our admissions team are a very dynamic group because we do appreciate that everyone's healthcare needs are unique. And so, yes, there are certainly times, especially in winter, where we also provide, isolation services for patients that may be positive for the flu or for COVID, and obviously we want those folks to have a safe place to recuperate and not continue to spread those diseases. And so we do often have to be creative in figuring out how we can accommodate and shift around, resources to ensure that we can continue to take patients. And I mentioned that we do accept folks from inpatient units, but the other side to that equation is that we also accept admissions from our shelter partners and clinics and our outreach teams on the street to try to mitigate either an emergency room visit or an inpatient stay, such that we may be able to bring someone in and meet their medical needs in respite as opposed to needing an inpatient level of care. It is a challenge, I think, especially for some newer staff, recognizing that respite is for acute medical needs, because often our folks have a variety of medical and behavioral health and different social determinants of health needs. And so trying to help patients to focus in on their top one or two priorities, but also appreciating that in 2 or 3 weeks, the reality is most likely that they're going to be going back to the community in the same way that they came to us, but also that we can help to reconnect them with the housing searches they've been doing or case management services to try to get themselves into a more stabilized living situation. And then also working with our outpatient teams to continue those efforts of both the medical care goals, but also, housing opportunities or other social and case management needs.
With regard to caring for the actual patient, you mentioned that there's a lot of different dynamics. So you do have some mental health issues, probably substance abuse. Dr. O'Connell, who you mentioned, has been here since the beginning. He did write a book, and it's a medical text, and it's called, I was researching this. It's actually called The Healthcare of Homeless Persons. How, as a nurse and working within the population, what differences do you think there are that you've seen with dealing, or I say dealing, but treating patients who may have a lot of other outstanding psychosocial issues, beyond their medical issue? And do you know if this text is still used at all today, or have you ever seen it?
I will say that it was on a back shelf at Pine Street and maybe part of my orientation. So yes, so I think the text, although dated in the early 90s, is still relevant today, you know, as long as folks put it in context. But it has a lot of images of certain diseases and presentations that the average nurse or doctor may not have experienced in their schooling or even in their providing care in other healthcare settings. And so I think there are certain conditions, you know, such as like lice and scabies infestations, which is not something that I think the average nurse has experienced in their careers. And so, you know, it's interesting because it infestations, I think, you know, you say the word long enough and everyone in the room starts to itch.
I've never seen something have nurses more freaked out than when you get a patient could come in with their arm cut off, bleeding out, or with just, you know, blood coming from every orifice, they're coating, they're dying, doesn't do anything. You say somebody has lice, and so many nurses are like, no, I don't want to take care of that. It's unbelievable. Sorry to digress, but it's one of those things that it's, you know, easily preventable, treatable.
Yes.
But it's something that just people get really freaked out about.
Well, and it's also why in some of our clinics, we have a clinic shower, because it is much easier to treat someone in our clinics as opposed to that person then creating chaos and or sometimes going to the emergency department, and maybe not having the actual care need met. And so we do also, I think, you know, within that, a lot of education with our partners as well. And, you know, reassuring shelter staff or staff in different spaces that, you know, although it may be a little anxiety provoking that someone has an infestation, it's handleable. And that, you know, there is a person under there and that we can, you know, get everybody a new set of clothes and a shower and continue on our day. But, you know, I also think that we see things like immersion foot, which is also known as trench foot, which, you know, folks think of as veterans and military experience.
Yeah, it's not something you commonly see here in the United States.
The reality is if you're in wet socks and shoes long enough, you're going to end up with that type of a condition. And so I think, you know, there are certain specific conditions like that that we may see more of than the average, you know, clinic. But then also how we take care of chronic diseases, you know, folks that may be trying to manage their diabetes. I need to give them a realistic option and I need to know what their food options are. You know, telling someone that they should eat healthy foods from Whole Foods is not going to go far with our patients. And so truly making a plan that, you know, maybe isn't in the template that we have as nurses for care plans, but appreciating what is offered for folks in terms of nutrition in the places that they are and, you know, encouraging them to pick the banana over the donut most days of the week. And so, and then also I think being creative with patients and get, you know, a lot of what drives our care and our ability to meet our patients' care needs is listening to them and having them trust us. And so as a nurse at Pine Street, I remember doing medication management with patients and having some patients that really knew their meds, but being specific about what they wouldn't take and digging into that a little bit. So a great example of something that impacts our patients is lack of bathroom access. And so I recognized in my time at Pine that we had some patients who very much understood that they had congestive heart failure or other reasons why they would need to be on a diuretic, but they had to be strategic about if they were going to take it every day and the timing of it, because they didn't know if they left the shelter in the morning when the next opportunity they would have to have bathroom access would be. And so I think that the work that we do to care for our patients also pushes us to understand the unique barriers that they face, but also the unique solutions that we can find. And often I think the patients we serve are underestimated in terms of their ability to advocate for themselves or to know what a reasonable goal of care is for them. And my experience and the experience of many staff here is that it really is listening to the patients and finding out what is going to work for them in the moment that they're in. Because how I'm going to have a conversation with a patient who's managing diabetes in the shelter versus that patient who's going to move into housing for the first time and have to cook their own meals on a budget is a much different conversation. And so I think the work that we do here, in my view, is always exciting because it pushes us to constantly be strategic and creative.
Well, there's something that to be said about personalizing healthcare too. It's for your patients and kind of knowing specifically what's going to work for them, which there's kind of this trend now that's trying to head that way, but it's still hard because I think that even starting at the top with physicians, they're taught, you know, algorithms will treat this way, that, and that. And so there's a blanket way to treat stuff, but it doesn't work for everybody, and especially the homeless population, like you're saying. Like, they don't have access to all the things that somebody who, you know, may have a better support system have. So to be able to personalize that and almost like kind of create a better way so they're successful in their own personal health care is huge. So I think that's something that's underappreciated as well. So I appreciate you guys for doing that to try to help people. Because patients are often treated, you know, in a blanket format where you come in, you have this diagnosis, we're going to give you these meds to treat you, see you later. And that doesn't always work. That's how you get people coming back to the emergency department, then readmitted to hospitals, and it's kind of sets people up for failure. So you're talking about a lot of times, like you're saying, where like access for people to, you know, get food. Do you work in conjunction with any food banks or any kind of like soup kitchens, anything in the area? Do you have contacts, you know, running those areas? Do you recommend people or any of your patients when they're outpatient or when they're back on the street that they go there to get food? Is that something that you guys do, or is it?
Yeah, so we actually have clinical spaces with some partners that serve meals and provide other services. And so, you know, we mentioned our clinics at the Pine Street Inn. We also have a clinic at St. Francis House, which is a day shelter that provides lunch and dinner, but also an array of, you know, recovery services and housing services. We work closely in other places to ensure that patients have access when they get housed, to make sure that they know what food pantries might be available in their area. And overall, you know, trying to integrate our care in places where folks may also be going for those needs.
And then, so we've talked a little bit about the medical services that the program provides, but there's also a variety of other services, including dental and behavioral health, and then just the social work aspect of it. I was wondering, like, if you could just touch on, like, first we can talk about kind of like the dental aspect of it, because that's something else that I don't think a lot of people think about, is just oral hygiene in general is something that a lot of people, it's expensive, even, you know, if you're someone who's just out on the street, not who's homeless. So I was wondering if you could kind of touch on the dental aspect and what you guys provide for services.
Yes, absolutely. So we have a robust dental clinic here at our 780 Albany Street location. And you're right, our dental practice actually sees many, many patients that don't otherwise get primary care here with us, which is unique because we appreciate that our dental practice, you know, patients that are coming here for dental don't have access to dental wherever they do have primary care. And so we try to offer dental services, recognizing that often, you know, in healthcare, they say above the neck is usually not as appreciated, meaning dental and behavioral health are not as much of a covered service as some of the other medical pieces. And so we do a lot in our dental practice around connecting patients to address different pain they may have been experiencing, or to your point, they may need more extensive procedures for which we can either navigate doing those here in-house, or we do sometimes refer folks to BMC for more advanced oral surgery needs. I think one of the most exciting things out of our dental practice this year is that our dental team and our contract and grants team work together, and we actually have a machine in our practice now that can make same day crowns for patients, which was a huge game changer because obviously multiple appointments in a series is a challenge for our patients with many competing priorities. So the fact that we're able to offer this service, and we've had several patients benefit from it thus far, is really exciting. And we try through our medical respite program to offer patients dental at times that, you know, you're here already and you haven't seen a dentist in a little while. And so we do try to, in the same way, engage folks that maybe not coming in specifically for dental, but once they appreciate that we have it, we're able to serve them. I think in terms of some of our other services, like behavioral health, and we have a fairly robust amount of addiction services that we provide, as well as specialty services. We have optometry at one of our clinics, and we have different folks that come in for dermatology and vascular work. And so coordinating with these specialty partnerships is really important, because having specialists come on site here for a clinic to see our patients in a space that they're more comfortable, they tend to be more successful in achieving that visit rather than sending them to some building on some hospital campus that they have a challenge navigating. But we truly do offer our services in a holistic way, such that if you're coming into any of our clinics, whether you're meeting with a nurse or a medical assistant or a provider as that first clinical touch, we're going to treat the person in front of us. So while we offer primary care, if folks have primary care in other places, we will still see you for any care need. It doesn't need to be urgent. But then also within that, if you're having behavioral health needs or needs to help to manage your addiction, it's all available. And so obviously, depending on the size of the clinic is you know, how much it is available in that space. But we do a lot of collaboration and connection across our own clinics to ensure that we're providing the services we need to those patients.
Yeah, so with regard to mental health, because it's something that, you know, for quite a while, mental health has, it's been an issue that didn't really receive adequate attention. And thankfully, in the last, I don't know, maybe 10 to 15 years anyway, it's come to the forefront of something that it can't be swept under the rug anymore. According to the National Alliance to End Homelessness, on a given night in 2023, 31% of the homeless population reported having a serious mental illness. 24% had conditions that were related to chronic substance abuse, and nearly 11,000 people had HIV or AIDS. Really large numbers here, just for the mental illness, substance abuse, and HIV and AIDS. And you guys, I know you have specific programs set aside for all those, but I don't know, I think this is a national survey here, relative to Boston. Do you see that a lot in Boston as well, just the mental health, substance abuse, and just a higher percentage?
Yeah, it's definitely a clinical triad that we see in the vast majority of our patients, where they have a high medical burden, but also behavioral health and addiction overlaying those medical issues as well. And I think that's why our services have to be quite so integrated in order to address those needs. And I think, you know, we also appreciate that some folks may not be able to engage in healthcare in a traditional way. And so, and by that, I mean making a scheduled appointment or navigating to where they need to go. And so we also have a fair amount of outreach and mobile services that occur, and I think are tailored such that if folks aren't comfortable coming into our spaces, hopefully we build trust in the outreach setting that we can hopefully get them into one of our clinics. But our outreach folks, both on foot and with our CCRI van, we have a mobile van that goes into the community that does a lot of work throughout the city. As well as different teams of folks that are going out and doing outreach. We have a fair amount of patients that we do prep for, as well as DOT for HIV meds and antibiotics and other things that folks may need. And so we really try to bridge the gap for anyone that may not be able to come into clinic in a more traditional way. But also appreciating that, you know, we have partnerships with the Pine Street Inn outreach van, and we still have staff that go out on that van in the evenings. And so I think really just access and offering our services to folks. And then, like I said, when you can meet people where they are in the outreach setting, we're much more successful in getting them to come in for treatment.
Yeah, so the Pine Street van, you mentioned that was like the initial, from what I was reading, like that's how it kind of started, right? Like there was no central base for the program. They got a van, they went around, tried to find people to help. So I'm assuming it's not the same van from 40 years ago, but same concept is still used today, though, just to kind of like feet on the ground almost to go and go to people instead of having to have them come to you.
Exactly.
So, which I think is really cool. Probably helps a lot of people who, like you said, may not otherwise get that help. So I applaud the program for that, too. Kind of as a follow-up, there was also a study done in the Journal of American Medical Association back in 2022, and the study was here in Boston, and it was related to drug overdose, and it found that in the homeless population, drug overdose accounted for 1 in 4 deaths, with a substantial increase in the opioid-related overdoses. So opioid crisis still going on. It's like to say it's a little bit better, but we're still seeing a lot of issues with drug overdose. Is this something else that you guys have seen within the program and trying to fight drug addiction? Do you provide Narcan to any of your patients who you know continue to use or maybe around that type of element?
Yes, we do a lot of work in this space. And to your point, we're starting to bend the curve on overdoses for certain people in certain places, but we still have a lot of work to do. You know, we ourselves internally have done a lot in terms of training our staff, not just clinical staff, but non-clinical staff, about overdose response as bystanders and how to, you know, be supportive if you are not at work and seeing someone that's in trouble. But I think in terms of our clinical services, we have Narcan as well as other safe supplies that we hand out to folks in a variety of outreach and different clinic settings. We do our best to try to do safety planning with patients around overdose prevention. And we also, you know, through our partnerships with the city and the state, try our best to offer, you know, treatment, whether that's prescribed treatment or, you know, facilitating a referral to more formal addiction treatment. It truly has become embedded in all of our clinics as something to respond to. And I would venture to say that the vast majority of our clinical staff have responded to some type of overdose within our clinical settings. And so appreciating that although we're making progress, we still have a long way to go. And there's still a lot of stigma in the community around Narcan and even just distribution of Narcan. Yeah. And so I think, you know, continuing our advocacy efforts and education efforts in the community in ways that even our patients are helping to support. I think in some ways our patients help to change the narrative around those things.
You had mentioned earlier the CCIR program, and you also have the SPOT program. I wonder if you could just kind of touch on those right now and how those also kind of help people who may be seeking some kind of are those for substance abuse?
We accept folks that are in any stages of substance use disorder, and so if they're pre-contemplative, we're happy to support folks and, like I said, do overdose prevention training and safe use techniques. But our SPOT program opened in 2017, and it is a converted conference room. Off of our main lobby here at 780 Albany Street. And it was the brainchild of one of our addiction doctors, Jesse Gaeta, and sort of formed out of necessity. So back in 2017, we started to see more folks in various states of sedation in and around our building. And so appreciating that as healthcare folks coming and going, you're going to stop and check on folks, but that we didn't always have a place, you know, bringing them into the clinic waiting room wasn't necessarily appropriate if they weren't asking for clinic services. But we also appreciated that we were calling EMS because people were out on the sidewalk, but we took their vital signs and they were okay-ish. And so I think what ended up happening is that we appreciated that for a lot of folks, if they just had a place to hang out and a nurse that was there to make sure that their vital signs were stable and we could support them with low-flow oxygen if we needed to. But ultimately, the people that we were seeing that were sedated didn't require emergency room level of care. And so SPOT was created as a low barrier space for folks to come if they were under the influence so that they could be monitored. But we also offer resources if folks are interested in recovery or other case management services, if they're working with housing or, you know, we've evolved now in the time that we've been down there. And now, despite the fact that it is a fairly small conference room, they do a fair amount of wound care down there and try to do as much as they can in a small space. There are certainly situations in which they'll coordinate with our clinic to have someone come up to an exam room. But for some of the patients, that also is an evolution in what they're comfortable with. And so the SPOT has really become a place where I think patients come in potentially not recognizing the services that are available in our building and may just need a space to stay safe. But once they appreciate that they can come in and they're not going to be judged and they're going to be treated with respect, it fosters that trust such that they do come back. And we do often meet other care needs or do referrals to further treatment or to, you know, navigate different housing pathways.
Which is, it's an interesting concept because it's, you know, a lot of people would probably balk at that and say, oh, well, you're just allowing, you know, a space for drug abuse or drug addiction. But it actually, it opens a door for these people to become, like you said, comfortable with the setting here, with the people here. And you can start to address other healthcare needs that can potentially lead to, you know, just at least a, you know, a better life for that person or healthcare recovery. So it's actually really cool if you look into like just the concept of it and the program and how it works. So another thing that's underappreciated. So if we could talk a little bit about like vulnerable populations too, which is something else that I think that I was reading about, you see a lot in homeless populations. If you could just talk a little bit about some vulnerable populations that people might not even, you know, tend to think about within the homeless community, veterans being one of them. But I know there are others like you probably have a better idea than I would.
Yeah, so to speak to veterans specifically, we have a very strong partnership with the New England Center and Home for Veterans. And we have one of our primary care clinics within their shelter, where we offer an array of services to both folks that are staying in the building. So the New England Center and Home for Veterans has both emergency shelter space, transitional space, and permanent housing space. And our clinic there serves all of those folks. And one of the nice things about New England Center and Home for Veterans is they serve any veteran that's ever served. And so what I've learned in our partnerships is that not all veterans are eligible for VA services and support. And so our clinic helps to bridge that gap for some of those folks, as well as I think about other sort of specialty populations. I would say that women experiencing homelessness deserve to be their own specialty population. They face a whole host of uniquely challenging situations, and we often are helping to support domestic violence and situations where folks may have experienced trafficking and other layers in which, for the women that we serve specifically, they're, even more vulnerable. And then within that, also families. We do have a family team here at Boston Healthcare for the Homeless Program, and their flagship clinic is located on Columbus Ave in Roxbury, and we've started a fairly robust pediatric primary care program in the last year and a half or so, and we're seeing lots of patients, but the need continues. And so I think we've felt that both on the family side and the adult side, the shelters have been full for several years now, and that wasn't something that we had experienced prior. And so when we talk about specialty populations, like, yes, families that have young children, and we're trying to bridge the gap of vaccines and making sure kids are set to go to school or daycare, but a population that I hadn't considered until I started working here is also the youth. So folks that may be aging out of the foster care system, or finding themselves otherwise, in a situation where they may be between 18 and mid-20s. And I think that group specifically is one that people may overlook, because those folks, I think fly under the radar a little bit more, right?
It's not to interrupt, but according to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, in 2024, more than one out of every four people experiencing homelessness was a child 18 years or younger, which most people don't think about children as being homeless, but it's definitely something that has been, an issue. So I'm glad that you guys have the PED services. And yeah, it's something that a lot of people don't think about, is that kind of 18 to 25 range. When I lived on the West Coast, I was in Portland, Oregon, and a large majority of the homeless were probably in that age range. And I don't know if that's something that's regional, if you see a higher population, and I'm not sure if that's something that there were a lot that, I don't know, they were heavy into drug abuse. I don't know if that's kind of when it starts. But to your point, aging out of the foster care system, where do you go after that if you don't have anywhere to go, if you have no family, mm-hmm. no resources? So do you guys see a lot of the kind of, I wouldn't call them younger, but definitely, young adults, I should say?
It's a smaller subgroup of the patients that we serve, but we do have some partnerships with Bridge Over Troubled Waters and other agencies that work specifically with youth, and so it is an area that our family team does focus on. I think the other group that we're seeing more and more of is elders that are becoming homeless, which presents its own host of challenges, because if folks have been aging in place in the community, shifting from that to an emergency homeless shelter and whether they can physically navigate that is a question. But also appreciating that some folks, that if they are elderly in their 70s and 80s, their healthcare needs may be complicated and such that the shelter and even our clinic within the shelter, you know, it's a challenge to navigate. And if someone is aging out of the community and their only option is the shelter, where do we go from here?
Yeah, there's some more statistics to throw at you here. It's estimated that by 2035, there'll be over 77 million people over the age of 65 in the U.S. And then right now, it's estimated that currently there are over 100,000 homeless over the age of 55. So think about 10 years, 20 years from now, are we going to see those numbers increase? And it's something in healthcare in general that's kind of scary, because you're eventually going to get to the point where you're going to have too many people needing healthcare and not enough people to take care of them, for multiple reasons. One, that just the nurses entering into the nursing profession, physicians entering the nursing, physicians profession, doctors, providers, those numbers are going to be far less than the amount of people we're going to see here who get into that older age. So you have your baby boomers and everybody else. And as it relates to, like I said, the numbers I threw out there, just as far as being homeless, it complicates things even more when you have older people with more complex medical issues. So, and do you see a lot of older people right now, or is it primarily, by older, I would mean over the age of 65?
So in certain places, yes. And I think that is the challenge of, you know, when we have folks that are on the younger side experiencing homelessness, the youth, things like that, there is opportunity to get folks in a space of wellness such that they might be able to work or have opportunities such that they can support themselves to move on from the shelter. But when we're seeing folks on the elder side, in some cases they have worked their whole lives or they've outlived their spouse or their family. And so in that space, if they have care needs such that they can't live independently, there's not a lot of alternatives or supports for what the next step beyond shelter would be for those folks. And we can all appreciate that they're not going to become more able as they age. And so that tension of they're in a shelter now and maybe being able to get by with the support of the shelter staff and our staff, but there does come a point where someone's care needs exceed what the shelter can do. And that is an operational challenge for us.
Yeah, where do you go from there, right? With regard to being able to place people in housing, so I know you guys work with other organizations trying to find kind of that bridge that gap of when people are ready to actually become housed. How much involvement do you guys have with that and trying to help find people permanent shelter?
We are involved very collaboratively with a lot of our shelter partners that are doing housing work. And then we also have certain care coordination programs and things in which our staff are helping to coordinate people to get into housing. And I think our role, regardless of if we're interfacing directly or, you know, in a more supportive way, is to try to help both the housing or shelter partner and the patient really define what it is that they might need to be successful in housing to begin with. And so if it's someone who, you know, maybe doesn't have access to other public benefits, so they're not going to be able to get food stamps or things like that, we need to ensure they know where they can go and get meals, where they're going to get housed. And so I think that coordination and thinking about what healthcare needs might exist, but also mobility. You know, we may have a patient that comes in and says, I have a housing opportunity and it's on the fourth floor of a walk-up and they intermittently have knee pain so bad that they can barely get up a flight of stairs. And it's a hard conversation, right? Because Here's this person who's experienced homelessness for years and they have this opportunity. But it's fairly clear from my nurse brain that this opportunity is not going to be long-term successful. And those conversations, always allowing the patient, obviously, to have the final decision, but really trying to get them to slow down and appreciate that, you know, finding the right fit is important. But also, on the flip side of that, ensuring that our relationships and advocacy with whoever's housing the patient is also appreciating that piece of it. We also are uniquely poised that you know, our street team and some of our other outreach teams also have the capacity to do home visits. And so when patients do make that transition from being either homeless on the street or in the shelter to housing, we're able to check in on them. And although home visits can sometimes take a lot more time, I will say, as a nurse that got to do them for a little bit in my career, it is enlightening, you know, when you get to see someone get settled into their own place and, you know, both the challenges that it presents, but also the successes and the shift. You know, I think most people would say, if I was experiencing homelessness and I got housed, that would be great. I would be so happy and excited. But the reality is, a lot of our patients, if they've experienced chronic homelessness for years, they typically experience some level of depression when they first get housed. And that's something that I think is counterintuitive to folks. And it was actually our consumer advisory board that brought it forward and started, they did a video a couple years back for our staff. And I think it's important to appreciate that, that's a reality for a lot of our patients, that although housing is a goal, there are sometimes unintended consequences of that shift in environment for them.
I was going to ask, like, so when it comes to being receptive, you know, just to getting care and to getting help and to getting, you know, even placed in somewhere else to live, do you ever find there's resistance at all for some people who, even though maybe they appreciate the help here and there, like they don't want any further help than what you're giving them?
I think that I would answer that by saying most of our patients are adults and we want to support them in their decision making. And so I think, yes, folks might be a little resistant or maybe just not ready for some of the opportunities that might be being offered to them. And I think it's important for us to appreciate that if someone is deciding not to engage, that that's not a reflection on our care personally, but where that person might be. And so I've always found that with our patients, even if they're giving you a hard no or no way, being able to appreciate and support that and say, that's fine, let me know if you change your mind, or, you know, those kinds of things. I think that's where our trust really comes into play, because I don't feel a certain kind of way about a patient that may not choose to engage in a certain pathway at a certain time.
I know that in my own experience with patients that I've had who have, you had mentioned kind of chronic homelessness, which is like persistent homelessness for a substantial amount of time, they're extremely independent. So, and it's the type of independence you have to learn, you have to, and so it's, maybe there's a sense of pride that comes with that as well. Like, I've survived this long, like, I don't want your help, I don't need your help, even though, you know, thanks for getting me to a point where I can be back on my feet. Mm-hmm. So I could understand that as well. So it must be hard too for some people, I think, just the pride aspect of it, of really needing to reach out and ask for that help. So, but I'm glad you guys are there for them and to help them. As far as that kind of staffing goes for you guys, I know that you had talked about you have all kinds of clinics, providers, and specialties. Are you volunteer? Do you have paid staff? Like, how do you staff most of your clinics? Not just, you know, nursing, but physicians, PAs, nursing assistants, all that stuff.
So the folks that are providing the care in our clinics are all employees. You know, our nurses and providers that are seeing patients and prescribing are all employees of the health center or some semblance of that. But we also have a fair amount of volunteers that come through the program. And they may be doctors and nurses, but that isn't the role that they play when they're volunteering here with us. They often help to support our clinics in different ways, or might come and help to facilitate bingo for respite or other, you know, types of things that support. But the actual care is done by our employees here.
And if anybody was interested in becoming one of these employees, how would they? Would they go to your website?
Or yes,
you guys? Okay,
our
you
website.
Guys, your own independent program. You're not,
yes,
run under the umbrella of anybody else, right?
No.
Okay.
And so, yeah, so we, like many other places in healthcare, are looking to hire nurses. We appreciate that the nurses are the backbone of a lot of the care that we provide here, specifically in our medical respite program where we have 24/7 nursing. And so while we're technically outpatient, even in respite, it does feel like an inpatient unit with some very dynamic folks. And so I think it's an amazing place to work, both outpatient and in respite. And we're able to really follow patients on their journey, both on the streets, in the shelter, and then when folks do finally make it into housing. And so it's a unique nursing role, or healthcare role to be in, for sure.
So with the population that you have, I'm sure you probably have some patients that you see, maybe not frequently, but they'll keep coming back. Do you guys have any kind of like a electronic healthcare record for them? I know most hospitals will have some kind of system set up, so it's easier, one, from a provider standpoint, to look historically when the patient was there, what meds they were on, why they were there prior. Do you use like Epic or anything like that, or do you have your own system set up so you can actually track and kind of when patients come back, just look at either their progress or what needs weren't met before?
Yes. So we've actually had an electronic health record longer than most health centers, is my understanding, because we're in so many different places. And so we do actually use OCHIN Epic in all of our sites. And it allows for, if a patient is seen here at 780 and then tomorrow they go and see someone at our St. Francis House Clinic, everyone has access to that documentation.
Which is going to be really helpful, not only for the provider, but for the patient as well, because then you don't have to sit there and remember every medication you were on or why you were there last time. So I just thought I'd ask. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, and I'll add, we have a HIPAA-compliant texting platform for providers to get in touch with each other. And I will say our outreach and clinic teams are amazing at getting folks in. You'll see the psychiatric nurse practitioner say, hey, so-and-so, so-and-so, and so-and-so are supposed to see me today if you can, direct them my way. And then the outreach folks are just so so-and-so, they're on their way. And so I think a lot of times our patients, like I said, have competing priorities. And so sometimes it is that reminder or that flexibility in that you might not have come at the time of your appointment, but you came on the day of your appointment. And so, if you're willing to hang out until the person that came on time is seen, we're happy to see you.
With regard to case management, you kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but how many case managers you guys have working for you? And it's got to be an exhausting job for them sometimes, just trying to track people down and find them and try and get them the help they need. Because aftercare is something that's huge, like something else people take for granted when you go to the hospital. A lot of times, okay, you're well enough to leave, you'll go home, no work for 2 weeks, come back and see your PCP, see somebody else. It doesn't work that way for homeless people. So how involved are your case managers with just trying to make sure that people, once you've seen them in one of your clinics or were in the hospital, you follow up with them?
Our case managers do have their work cut out for them. And I think we have several different varieties of, I would say, case management and care management. And, I think we do have, complex care programs, and our patients are part of them. But it's interesting because a lot of care management programs rely on telephonic communication. And our patients, while most of them do have phones, the phone numbers can change quite frequently, and or the service of the phone may or be on or off depending on the time of the month. And so we appreciate that, with our care managers and our case managers, a lot of it has to be physical outreach or, catching that patient when they come into shelter or clinic. And so I think our teams are really well poised at, case managers getting folks into clinic or maybe rescheduling appointments and things, but all working together, that if that person actually comes into clinic, we get them seen by as many people as available to see them as possible. But our case managers throughout the program really do serve a variety of different things for our patients, whether that's you know, getting them their vital documents and help with identification that they may need for housing or other situations, different legal support and navigating things that they may need to clear up to be eligible for housing. And then the medical case management pieces of if they need durable medical equipment or if they have med deliveries by the pharmacy. And so it is a challenge for sure. I think one of the keys is having open access case management available for patients, because that's the other piece of it is, you know, having a case manager available to see someone after they've seen their doctor, because they're already here. And being able to try to have as much impact with as little time of the patient as possible.
Have you, you've worked here for a while. Are there a multitude of cases or any cases you can think of where you've had people that have just successfully found housing and moved on and come back to see you guys? And it must be extremely, it must make you feel really great when that happens. But I don't know if you have any stories like that you can share just to kind of, you know, show that this is a successful program. It's been going on for a long time and that there are success stories to go along with, you know, what a lot of people might not see is, you know, or may see as a hopeless kind of, you know, lifestyle for some people.
I definitely have my fair share of patient success stories. I think, you know, one of the things that was that our consumer advisory board made sure that we were intentional about is that when patients do have the opportunity for housing and maybe stable housing long term, that that doesn't change the fact that they're our patient, and that the patient gets the option of staying with us at Boston Healthcare for the Homeless program for their primary care or moving on to wherever in the community they'd like to. And I will say my experience with patients has been varied, you know, working at Pine for years and, you know, we help patients manage medications there. So in some cases, I'm seeing someone every day that I'm working, not that I'm caring for them, but they're at least coming to access their meds. And when folks would, you know, sometimes they would quietly tell us they were getting into housing. And for some patients, it was like, you guys were great. I never want to have to set foot in this building again. Thanks a lot. I'll be in touch when I find my new primary care. And you have to appreciate that, right? Folks don't want to be reminded of maybe the hardest time in their life. But then you hear the opposite of that, of, you know, this doctor or this nurse cared for me when I was in my worst place, and this is the best care that I've ever gotten. And so I don't want to leave unless you're telling me I have to. And so I had some patients from our medical director at Pine that had been housed for well over 5 years. Wow. And they were still coming in. The one guy, it was only once a year or twice a year, but he would come in and it was so refreshing, you know, to just know someone that you had seen in the shelter day after day and see them move on and be successful. You know, in some, there was one patient in particular who I cared for in the shelter, and he had a bunch of health needs and a hip replacement and all kinds of things that occurred, for which he was actually in a nursing home for a little while. And that actually almost prevented him from housing because he lost his homeless status. And so that is one of the weird systems issues that you don't appreciate until you do this work, is that people that stay in shelter are tracked. And so when folks are chronically homeless, there is data that supports that, that someone's been in an emergency shelter or seen on outreach or XYZ. And so there are occasions where if someone has a profound medical issue and is, whether it's inpatient or in a nursing home or even at the Barbara McGinnis house for months, they lose that status. And so there are ways in which our teams have figured out how to advocate to get people back on those lists and to appreciate that it was a medical issue, not that they...
Yeah, it seems counterintuitive, right? Like, you're homeless. Wait, you're in the hospital. You're not homeless. Oh, wait, no, you're out of the hospital. You're homeless. It's, yeah.
Right. And so for this particular patient, his journey from shelter to housing was a little over a decade. And so I actually hadn't seen him in quite a while. And it was right before the holidays a couple years ago. And I was walking in and he was at our pharmacy and he said, "Hey, April." And I looked over and he just like pulled his keys out of his pocket. And I was like, "Are you serious?" And after a decade, he finally had his housing.
Wow.
And so it's interesting that you say that folks may perceive our work as being depressing. To me, it couldn't be more uplifting. You know, the resilience of this man that I knew in an emergency shelter that then had a, you know, a lot of different medical complexities and inpatient and this and that and the other. And then to come out on the other side of it and to see him happy and, you know, being able to invite his daughter over for holidays and things like that is truly incredible. So I think it's more just appreciating that it's the long game. And that, you know, for some folks, success is that they're coming back through our doors the next day. I think, you know, we wish that all of our patients could get into permanent housing. But we see, you know, 11, 12,000 patients a year, and I'm pretty sure there's not that many available units.
Wow.
And so I think that what we consider success and what folks may see success for us are two different things. And really, it's about showing up and honoring the resilience of our patients day in and day out.
If you had April's wish list, like of just like, you know, your fairy godmother comes in and says, "April, I'm going to give the program whatever you want." What's the, like, what are the top two or three things that you would ask to help either, you know, improve your patients or just the workflow? Like, what would you ask for?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one.
Yeah, this is kind of a surprise question. Sorry. No heads up on this one. Even one thing, like, can you think of anything that you would love to have either more funding for or more help with or even just, you know, more staff?
Oh, dear. I mean, I will take all the nurses that we need in one fell swoop as I think about, you know, the urgent needs of our program right now. When I think about the systems that we have to pull our patients through, I wish that insurance coverage was easier to navigate for patients and to ensure. I think that, you know, folks, especially if they're experiencing homelessness or maybe having touches with law enforcement and you know, things like that, is it's in some cases our folks don't know that they've lost their coverage until they try to go to the pharmacy and pick something up. And then the complexities of insurance these days with the ACOs and who do you pick and your primary care. And I think just the translation of all those things to our patients, but then also appreciating that mail is a challenge for our patients. And if you get a correspondence from your insurance company that gets returned, they just assume that you don't live here anymore and can take you off the books. And so I think that, like, the insurance piece is huge of once they're on it, keeping them on,
yeah,
like keeping coverage such, because that creates so many barriers for meds and things like that. And then also, if it's truly the fairy godmother that can do anything, if we could just get rid of the stigma around substance use disorder and mental health, that would make our jobs a lot easier.
That's a hard one. And it's, I think it's, people are actually talking about it more now, which is helpful.
Right.
But it's still there. And I mean, it's something that, I don't know, it's hopefully generationally, people will over time kind of realize that, you know, mental health is something that we need to pay more attention to as much as physical health, which for a long time we haven't. So I agree with you on that one. Do you have anything else, anybody that you would like to thank, comment on, anything else you'd like to speak about with regard to the program? Anybody who might be interested in joining or had any other questions, thoughts, comments?
I think so. We covered quite a bit.
We did. One thing I do want to say is what I truly appreciate is that their chief operating officer is somebody who started as a nurse in the program and worked their way up through it so they could see on the ground level what it was like. So a lot of, and this even happens a lot in hospitals and just kind of medical corporations, they will hire somebody for their chief operating officer who maybe hasn't had that experience before. So it's refreshing, and I think it gives you a perspective that a lot of people don't have, which is fantastic. So I really love that about the program. So April, thank you so much for joining us. So for anybody who's listening, April, first of all, thank you very much. Any RNs out there who are interested, do you guys have full-time, part-time, per diem, all that stuff?
Yep, we have full-time, part-time, per diem. Check out our website. We have a variety of full-time positions in different places throughout the program. And we are an incredible place to work. And I think the thing that makes us the most incredible is the patients that we serve.
And you guys, with regard to nursing, do you hire new grads? Do you need experience?
We do hire new grads, and then in some of our positions, we do need some more experienced nurses. So if you're interested and you want a nursing position that allows for you to really use your nursing brain, I think what is exciting and dynamic about the work here is that we allow for nurses to really work at the top of their licenses and work really collaboratively with our providers to ensure that our patients are having the best outcomes and get the support that they need.
Well, April, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming on and sharing this. Like I said, it's a program a lot of people don't realize exists. And I know that other cities, when the program first started 40 years ago, other cities were also including these grants. I have no idea if they're still around or not. But here in Boston, I think it's really important, especially in this area that we're in right now. So South Boston, this is infamously around this area is called Methadone Mile. It's been a long history of substance abuse, mental health disorders. So I'm glad that this program exists and, of course, that it's centered here to help that population. So really important. Thank you so much for joining. Anybody out there listening, if you have any questions or comments, can be reached at youmakemesickpod@gmail.com. And we're also on X at makemesickpod. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and please remember to wash your hands. Dr. Jim had a dream with a heart so wide. 40 years strong by humanity's side. April steps in with a vision so clear. Together they've conquered every shadowed fear. Heal this city one heart at a time. Boston's beacon shining so divine. For every soul that's lost in the street, they're building love where hope and care meet. For the homeless, they've paved the way, turning the darkest nights and brighter days. No one forgotten, no one unseen. Dr. Jim and April living that dream. Heal this city one heart at a time. Boston's beacon shining so cold and rain, mending the weary, easing their pain. Every embrace, a promise they keep, sowing dreams where despair runs deep.